Vidal. I waited for Rose to spot the framed photograph of Daddy and Mama on my dresser. She said, "Who's that?" I said, "That's my father." She said, "Who's that with him?" And I said, "That's my mother." And she just stared at the picture, then looked back at me and said,
"Not your natural mother."
"What do you mean?"
"Not your blood kin."
"Yes." Then she looked back at the picture.
"I can't see it."
"No one can."
"What is she?"
"Canadian." Rose blushed. "Hooray." But I put her out of her mystery. "She's Lebanese."
"She's an Arab?"
"They don't like to be called Arabs, especially not Arabs."
"What's wrong with that? That's how I've always said it."
"Well, anyhow, a lot of Lebanese come from the coast, and they're more Mediterranean, more European, you know? Not like Arabs."
"She must have come from inland."
Then she looked at me and said,
"Could have fooled me."
I said, "I'm not trying to fool anyone."
"You look pure white."
"I am pure white. My mother is white."
"Not quite."
"Well, she's not colored." She smiled, sneered is more like it, and said,
"Don't worry, honey. You plenty white for the both of you."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Now you're mad 'cause I called you white."
She was laughing at me. "I like to be called by my name, please." She stopped laughing and looked at me for a moment and said,
"Kathleen."
But I wanted her to get to the point. "I'm not ashamed of my mother, but I take after my father. My mother is devoid of ambition and not terribly bright, although she is a devoted parent."
"Goody for you."
I was on the tip of my tongue to say, "To hell with you," or worse, when she got serious all of a sudden and said,
"I'm sorry, but you're not being honest with me. You are ashamed of your mother."
I got a hot, sick feeling in my stomach.
"And I think that's a sorrowful thing,"
she added. The feeling was coming up through my skin. I was sure Rose could smell it.
"Kathleen?"
She looked so sorry for me. And that's what made me feel strange. In a sticky dream with my eyes on sideways and can't stand up.
"I'm sorry," she said.
I had to lean over.
"Are you okay?"
I thought, please, God, don't let me throw up.
"Want me to get Giles?"
I must have caught a bug. The floorboards were shifting. She put her hand on the back of my neck.
"Breathe,"
she said. Her hand was cool.
"Good," she said. "But the idea is, once you've breathed out, it helps to breathe in again in the near future."
"That's it." I breathed, and she kept her hand there until my head stopped spinning and my stomach cooled down. "I'm okay now." We lay on my bed and played Chinese checkers for an hour, and Giles brought us cocoa and oatmeal cookies. I wanted Rose to stay overnight so we could tell ghost stories, but she has to be home by 9 or her mother worries. The next day I told Rose she was in a state of social mortal sin because she had yet to invite me to her home. I have to come like a thief in the night, and even then she doesn't ask me in. I asked her point blank, why not? She said,
"My mother is an invalid."
She was lying. I could tell by the veil that came down over her eyes, but I went along with it. "I wouldn't make any noise. You could just show me your room," she said.
"We'll see."
"Say yes."
"Okay."
"When?"
"I'll check."
Days went by, and she still couldn't say when, so I gave her the cold shoulder, but that didn't work. She's immune to her own methods. So last night I went over uninvited. At the decent hour of 7:30, when I knew supper would be through and it would be early enough to take the streetcar instead of a leering cab ride. There were lots of kids playing in the street, and mothers everywhere, sitting on their porches in the cool of the evening. Men, too, in white shirt sleeves, some leaning against the buildings in twos and threes, others playing checkers, everyone chatting. It reminded me of New Waterford, except Harlem is really prosperous. Not to mention that here I'm the odd one out. Everyone stared at me as I slunk by till I felt like something out of P.T. Barnum. "See the white slave princess raised by wolves in darkest Canada." A couple of young fellows sang a little song at me as I passed. Softly, not nasty or anything. But it made me blush anyhow, calling me sugar and baby. Oh, what I'd give to be invisible. Or to be taken for a man. Before I got to her building, I could hear Rose playing. It was coming from the church window. But church was not in session, and this was definitely not church music. It was pure Rose. So this is where she practices. In exchange for playing on Sundays, I guess. I stayed under the window, sheltered by Rose's music. But I was soon disturbed by three women seated on kitchen chairs on the front stoop of her building. They didn't shoo me away. They gave me the lowdown on Rose. They didn't know whether to feel sorry for her or to think she was nuts. I knew the feeling. "Poor little girl," they were saying. "She bears her cross." "We all bear a cross," I wanted to say. "She's not a little girl." And I had to laugh because they went on, "and practicing 24 hours a day, but can never learn a piece of music top to bottom, no matter how hard she try." "That's right, just wandering on the keyboard, lost to the world. 'Cept Sunday, she plays like the angels come Sunday. That's the Lord's work. Thank you, Jesus." Then one of them prayed that Rose would get some humility. And they made jokes because they considered her too strange. And of all things, homely to get a husband. And what's the good of pride in a homely woman? I excused myself, but the women didn't seem to notice. They just kept chatting as I picked my way past them up the steps and in through the front door for the first time. The entrance has an echoey vaulted stone ceiling with turquoise and white tile mosaic. Maybe it was once a Turkish bath. I smelled a delicious stew. I followed a wide brass rail up marble steps worn to soft curves by 100 years of footfalls, up to the second floor landing, and was about to enter the church to surprise Rose when I had a flash. An evil one. I continued up to the third floor landing and knocked at the door of what I knew must be her apartment. For a minute, I thought there was no one home, and I was halfway back down the stairs when a woman's voice stopped me. "What can I do for you, honey?" I turned to the woman and said, "Sorry, wrong apartment."
"Who you looking for?"
"Rose LaCroix."
"Rosie's downstairs practicing."
"Okay, I'll just pop down and say hello."
"She doesn't like to be disturbed."
"It's all right. She knows me." The woman smiled in a sly kind of way and said,
"You don't know her too well, though, do you? Come on in and wait. She'll be up for dinner in a few minutes."
"Oh, thank you." I was confused. "I don't want to intrude on your dinner."
"You won't if you join us."
I followed the woman into the parlor. It was fancy and shabby at the same time, like a rich lady who slept in her clothes. Velvet everything. A plushy plum sofa with shiny patches. Dusty curtains drawn, burgundy with gold tassels. And a huge gilt mirror over the mantelpiece. The stew smell mixed with her perfume and made me feel a bit queer. I said, "I'm Rose's friend from singing class, Kathleen Piper."
"Oh, yeah? I didn't know Rosie had a little friend."
I felt she was being ironic, not to mention rude, but I couldn't figure out why. No more could I figure out who she was, although she clearly knew Rose.
"I'm sorry, honey. I'm Rose's mother, Jean. Do sit down."
I guess my chin must have dropped a mile, but I couldn't help it. I was speechless. She lit a cigarette and laughed at me in a lazy way. She was wearing a full-length evening dress, dull red satin, slim and loose, with skinny little straps and a deep V-neck, black sequin flowers, and obviously no underthings. I think that shocked me more than the fact that she was white, with straight yellow hair falling anyhow onto her shoulders, and thin blue eyes. Tiny lines. She must be close to 40, but it was so dim in there I couldn't tell. You could see she used to be pretty. No face paint, oddly enough. She was enjoying my amazement. She offered me a cigarette. "No, thank you."
"Good. Keep your voice clean. Drink?"
"Yes, please." She smiled that rudely familiar smile again, as if my accepting a drink made us lowly conspirators. For there was something low about her, and yet she acted like bored royalty. I don't go in for drinking, but I didn't want this woman calling me Rosie's little friend again. She gave me a whiskey and leaned back in the sofa across from me. Her left strap slipped down, but she didn't seem to notice. I said, "Thank you."
"I know you're surprised, honey. Everybody is, at first. My God, you're pretty."
I hate myself that I blush so easily. She was making me madder by the second, I thought. So this is what Rose lives with. I'd go around like a hornet, too, if she were my mother. But I said, "Thank you, ma'am."
And she laughed at me again.
The word languid is always used in books, but I finally found a use for it in real life. Mrs. Lacroix was languid.
"Call me Jean, baby."
"I'm not your baby," I thought, but I said, "Jean."
And she chuckled again and looked me up and down and said, "Oh, yes. Yes, indeedy."
She made me most uncomfortable,
the way she lounged there, scrutinizing me like a bird of prey that's too full with its recent meal to be bothered to eat what's in front of it.
Rose came in. She paused when she saw me. I couldn't read her face. She just said,
"Hi."
"Hi."
Jean grinned and said, "Rose, darling, your friend is simply charming. I insist you stay for dinner, Miss Piper."
"Please call me Kathleen, ma'am, Jean." She winked at me. I blushed again. I looked at Rose, expecting her to be scowling at me, but she just said, "Want to see my room?" I got up, relieved, although it crossed my mind that maybe Rose would murder me silently with a pillow once I got in there. Her mother stopped us on our way.
"Did you get my prescription, Rose?" she asked without turning around.
"Yes, Mother, I got it."
"Good. We'll wait till after dinner. I'm actually feeling quite spry today."
"Good.
You girls have a little gossip. I'll call you when dinner is laid."
"Thank you, Mother." This was the strangest thing of all, to find out that Rose has not a mama, but a mother. It's raining on the Bay of Fundy. There's no particular ferryman this time, there's a crew. No one speaks to her as she boards, or asks her who her parents are. No one looks worried, although they do look a little askance. 28 days since New Waterford. What is Lily to do about the soles of her boots? She hugs the diary and looks over the rail. The Nova Scotia mainland is behind her. New Brunswick is in front. "Farewell to Nova Scotia, your sea-bound coast. Let your mountains dark and dreary be. For when I'm far away on the briny ocean tossed,
Will you ever heave a sigh and a wish for me? Rose's room is as different from the rest of the apartment as can be. She has a single bed with an absolutely plain white cotton spread and no headboard. There is not even a rug on the floor. A wooden chair, a small desk with a pen and a blank sheet of paper, and of all things, the Holy Bible, open it. But I didn't get a chance to see because she flipped it shut the moment I glanced at it. You'd think I'd caught her reading a racy novel. It looks like the nuns' rooms at Holy Angels. I know, because I snuck into their wing on the last day of school, hoping to find a long, luscious wig in Sister St. Monica's room, but no such luck. The only difference is, instead of a crucifix on the wall, there's a picture of Beethoven. And do you believe this? She hasn't got a mirror. Rose closed her door behind us and said, "So, want to play Chinese checkers?" "Why didn't you tell me she's white?"
"Why should I?"
"I told you about my mother."
"What about her?"
"You said she's not white."
"She got a year-round tan. That don't count for colored."
"You said it did the other night."
"Yeah, well, that's a moot point, isn't it? Considering how you come out."
"I can't win, can I?"
"Oh, yes, you can. There ain't nothing stopping you, girl."
"You hate me 'cause I'm white."
"I hate you 'cause you're so fucking ignorant."
"Then enlighten me."
"Why should I bother?"
"Because I'm your friend."
"Friends don't spy."
"I'm sorry. You give me no alternative."
"There's an alternative. Leave me alone."
"No."
"Why not?"
"I like you."
"Why?"
"You're the smartest person I know, except for my father."
"Is that supposed to be a compliment?"
"And you're beautiful." That shut her up. She looked at me as though I'd told her she had a year to live. So I added, "But your mother dresses you funny."
"It doesn't matter what I wear."
"You're right. You're so gorgeous, it doesn't matter."
"Shut up."
"Come to Mecca with me tonight."
"I told you, I can't."
"Do you do everything your mother tells you?" She sat down on the bed, folded her hands in her lap, and quoted scripture.
"She has my best interests in mind."
"Oh, really? What are those?"
"Getting out of this dump."
I sat down next to her. I tried to be delicate. "What's wrong with her?"
"Nothing. She does her best."
"You're the one who's ashamed." Rose got quiet and looked at me as though she were holding a puppy and begging me not to hurt it.
"You think because she lives here she's not a fine person? Well, it's only because of me that she has to live here."
"Do you know what that's like for her?"
"They treat her like trash. They don't know anything about her. Ignorant niggers."
I couldn't speak. Rose went on.
"She's given up everything for my sake."
"She seems pretty satisfied to me."
"She's too polite to seem otherwise."
"I didn't think she was the slightest bit polite." Rose really looked bewildered. How can she know so much about so many things, yet know so little about her own mother? But I just said, "Where's your hat?" I followed her out across the parlor and past the kitchen, where Jean was setting the table. That is, she was standing there with a fork in her hand, staring into space. Rose took me into Jean's bedroom. I should say boudoir. A mess of satin sheets and a huge mahogany bedstead with claw feet. A big oil painting over the bed of a fat white woman getting out of a tub. A vanity littered with silver brushes, pots of paint, and clumps of yellow hair. A crystal cocktail glass with lipstick smears. An ashtray crammed with red-tipped butts, a jumble of jewelry, tweezers, and an eyelash curler, clothes strewn everywhere, and too many smells for one room. Rose opened a big wardrobe, rummaged through the top half, and pulled down the charcoal fedora.
"Rosie!"
It was Jean from the kitchen. She sounded like she'd just hurt herself. Rose whipped the hat back onto the shelf and shot from the room. I got it down again and put it on, and went back out to the parlor. Rose's back was to me. But Jean was looking straight at me from the sofa where she lay. She looked like she was in pain, but somehow still slightly amused to see me in the hat. It gave me the creeps. Rose was reaching into her school bag. I could see the sheet music inside. She brought out a needle that she filled from a tiny bottle. Jean had her left arm flung out, and she was pumping her fist. The vigor of that action didn't go with the swoon in her body. Her face was starting to tighten and go even paler. She was looking at the ceiling now. Rose injected her, and Jean closed her eyes as though she were lost in prayer like the nuns. Her fist relaxed. She gave a little moan, reached up, and stroked Rose's face. She murmured something, then nodded off. Rose folded Jean's arm across her stomach, stood up, and saw me. She suffers a lot of pain. I felt embarrassed for Rose having to lie again.
Did she see you in the hat? She asked me.
I think so.
Please don't do that again. It upsets her.
I'm sorry.
I handed her the hat.
Do you have a picture of him? I asked.
No.
Don't you have anything besides his hat?
Rose looked at her mother on the sofa, out cold, and led me back into the boudoir, and disappeared into the wardrobe.
I had this crazy idea that she might be gone forever into another time and place. But she came out a moment later with a suit of men's clothes on a hanger, black and tan pinstripe trousers, black waistcoat and tails, tan cravat with black polka dots, starched white shirt with diamond studs.
"Goes with the hat," I said. And she said, "Yeah."
And I said, "Try it on." She didn't pretend to be shocked, which is how I know that in her heart of hearts it had occurred to her before. It's also how I knew that certain things between us were behind us now.
"Thank goodness," she just said. "I couldn't do that."
"Why not?"
"It would be like sacrilege."
"He wasn't God. He was just some fella."
"He was my father."
"And all he left you were his clothes." She hesitated, so I started to undress.
"What are you doing?"
I didn't answer because I didn't know. I just pulled my dress over my head and got to work on my stockings, and for some reason it worked, and she said, "All right, all right." And I put my dress back on as she undid the millions of buttons on hers and said, "Turn around." I obliged. She took forever.
"Don't peek."
"I'm not peeking."
Finally, she said, "Okay, you can look now."
I turned around. Oh, my. She is a tall, slim young man in a curious suit of black and tan. There is nothing to beat her leaning against the brick of any building twixt here and Battery Park. She said,
"How do I look?"
"You're coming out with me."
"I..."
"Look at yourself." She hesitated, so I closed the closet door to expose the full-length mirror on the outside. I stood behind her as she looked at the beautiful young man with the fine-cut face between hat and cravat. She looked at herself for a long time, and finally,
"Do you think?"
"Oh, yeah." She nodded to herself and turned sideways. I said, "Your own mother wouldn't recognize you, much less your mother's friends."
"Do you have any money on you?"
$2.
"I've got car fare."
"Let's go."
"No."
I thought, "Oh, brother, she's got cold feet." But she offered me her arm with a smile and said,
Let's dine first.
Jean had somehow managed to lay the table. It was just a kitchen table between the sink and the icebox, but it was covered with a snowy lace cloth and set with silverware engraved with J.B. Rose lit the candles. She filled our crystal goblets with bubbly root beer and heaped the bone china plates with what we call boiled dinner down home. Potatoes, carrots, pork hocks, she calls them pig's feet, doughboys, but instead of cabbage, there were green leaves of some kind. Daddy was right. There has come a time when I think it's the most delicious dish in the world. We sat across from each other and clinked our glasses. To Mecca.
To Mecca.
And drank. There was a place set for Jean, too.
She doesn't eat much, anyhow,
said Rose. It's good luck to set an extra place at table.
Why?
In case your guardian angel wants to join you.
Don't spook me.
They're not spooky. They look after you.
You don't believe that.
Oh, yes, I do.
Why? What's your guardian angel ever done for you?
Sent me to New York. Made me meet you.
Lucky you.
We're going to know each other for the rest of our lives. After a moment, she said,
I don't think I have a guardian angel. I think I'm on my own.
You have one as long as I'm around. She listened, and I could tell she wanted to believe me, and I didn't think about what I was saying, I just said it. And if I die before you, I'll come back. She got tears in her eyes, and so did I. It always happens when you talk about ghosts. I had two helpings of stew. Would you believe Jean cooked it?
She does all the cooking.
So I guess she's not a completely useless mother after all. What does J.B. stand for?
Rose hesitated, then said, Julia Burgess.
Who's that?
My grandmother.
She alive?
Yeah.
Where's she at?
Long Island.
Do you visit her often?
I've never met her.
I've never met my grandparents either.
To hell with them all.
I'll drink to that. We toasted again. Then I raised my goblet for the third time. Let's drink to the 20th century, I said, because it's ours.
To the 20th century.
Do you think it's possible to get drunk on root beer? Lily plucks big waxy leaves from a maple tree and replaces the lining of what's left of the soles of her boots. She walks across the United States border into Maine, and the road turns from gravel to pavement. She kneels down by the side of the road and says a little prayer because, after all, she has entered a foreign country. This is at a spot near Calais, and if you go there now, your watch will stop. Lily knows where she is going. It is only necessary to keep to the coast. If she can see the ocean on her left, she can't get lost. We quickly washed the dishes, then Rose fixed a silver tray with two glasses, an ice bucket, a canister of soda, and a bottle of whiskey, and put it on the coffee table next to the sofa where Jean lay. I was nervous that Jean would wake up and catch us, but Rose said,
Don't worry. She won't wake up till her company comes.
I didn't ask what company, because I didn't want to make Rose lie to me again. She led me to the door and opened it for me, très galant, saying,
Ladies first.
As I stepped through the door, I turned my head to smile at Rose and caught sight of Jean in the mirror over the mantelpiece. She was lying perfectly still on the sofa, staring straight at me. Do you think there's such a thing as a ghost who masquerades as a person? Do you believe that there are people whose bodies are still alive here on earth, but whose souls are already in hell? Lily loses sight of the water for days at a time, stopping to inquire, "Where's the water?" She is far from the only one walking the roads. She shares a meal of boiled potatoes with a slow, thin man from Oklahoma. He's not going anywhere in particular. She asks him where the water is. He leads her to railway tracks that swing southeast until the ocean comes in view. That night, between the trees and the track, under a pure black sky, he talks about his home in the land of milk and honey, and Lily asks why he left.
"It blew away," he says. "What's that you're reading?"
"My mother's diary."
"Where's your ma?"
"She's dead."
"Well, you hang on to that book. That's a precious remembrance."
And he shows her a picture of his wife and baby. "Are they dead?" Lily asks.
"Not so far as I know."
Lily is awakened by his bad chest. She watches him sleep, and his wheezing stops, but when she nods off, his torment resumes. So she stays awake. At dawn, he sits up and forgets to cough. He scoops her up by the waist and pelts, years younger, toward the line of prehistoric boxcars lumbering by, all rust and thrust. "I didn't tell Rose that her mother had seen us. What a feeling to walk arm in arm with Rose as a fella. People stared in a whole new way. I guess I've found the one thing that could make me look even more suspicious in this neighborhood. It was a breezy evening. Rose had polished her old black lace-ups to a high shine, and I wished like crazy I had my new dress on. Oh, well, next time." I had to force her through the door of Mecca as though at gunpoint. The great thing about Mecca is that there's all kinds. I'd never soaked the place up like I did last night with Rose. I saw it all through her eyes, and I was able to point out the regulars. It's mostly young colored men and not that many women. The fellas are all slick dressers except for the holes in their pockets where the money's burned through. They're earning more than miners, building tanks and artillery for over there. I know because I've been told by the guy in the silk tie called Aldridge. I've never seen guys preen and present themselves the way they do. They lean against the bar like honey-drenched stamens, waiting for the women to buzz around, and you just know they're all breaking their mothers' hearts. They wear secret smiles and chuckle a lot when they chat with the white guys. There are a couple of middle-aged men, too. A famous jockey who eats 5 heads of lettuce a day, and a retired heavyweight champion with a bald head from Halifax. They're the only ones who bring their wives, 2 very serious-looking women of a certain age, who spend the whole time with their heads glued together, chatting. There's a group of West Indian fellows who stick together and wear pencil-thin mustaches. One of them's a lawyer, and another is my acquaintance, Nico, a little live wire who has made a fortune in real estate and can't stop smiling. He calls me Cherie. There's a studious young man who always sits alone and writes in a notebook, and there are 2 tables pushed together of motley individuals who are delighted with each other and everything else, and who turn out to be actors. There's a Chinaman who holds court at the same table in the far corner every night. Tonight I notice 3 or 4 other white girls sitting with their colored boyfriends, and I say to Rose that at least we're not the only mixed couple in the joint. And she says, "Yes, we are." I say, "They don't look colored." And she says, "Say Negro." As for the white denizens, a handful of tough-looking Irishmen in $50 suits with dames on their arms, a Jew who brings his barrel of hats into the club with him. He's a very formal older man who closes his eyes and nods slowly to the music, no matter how wild the tune. Tonight there's also a high society table out for a low time. Girls and boys who have no idea where they are and think themselves awfully clever for being there. They probably think the same of me. There are also a few working girls of every shade who arrive alone and leave escorted several times throughout the evening under the watchful eye of the gamekeeper, who lounges in the corner consulting his solid gold watch. I sometimes wonder, can it be any harder than washing floors or having 7 babies? Business must be booming because the management has installed a small stage, footlights, and a sparkly purple curtain with Mecca, written a la Araby in gold sequins against a silhouette of minarets. 10 minutes after we sit down, a man in a tuxedo comes out from behind the curtain and announces, "Ladies and gentlemen, Club Mecca proudly presents Ali Baba and his 40 Follies." The curtain parts on a harem. Light-skinned girls and a very fat, dark sultan lounge on striped pillows. The girls dance the 7 veils while he sings a song of illicit lust for one of them, the lightest one, and the band plays snaky music. The tent flaps part, and handsome Prince Ahmed pokes his turbaned head through and kisses the heroine. Then, bingo, you're in Gay Paris doing the can-can. And then the same young lovers flee the evil sultan all through the world's capitals, while the chorus girls quick change and outdance Ziegfelds. We went to Hawaii, Japan, Holland, and Canada, where they pretended to be Eskimos and Mounties. And although the girls changed costumes and countries every 5 seconds, they never wore more than 6 square inches, even when they were fur-clad in Canada's frozen wastes. After the show, the band played dance tunes, but I couldn't for the life of me get Rose up on her feet. She did, however, graciously nod when other gentle and not-so-gentlemen requested her permission to dance with me. I danced with the busted-nosed Irishman, built like a tree stump but light on his feet boy, with the Jewish haberdasher, who made a waltz out of everything, with a lily-white boy from Long Island. I asked him if he was acquainted with the Burgesses, and he answered importantly that they were his dear friends. I asked him if he knew Jean, and he got a blank look, then said, come to think of it, there was a daughter years ago who died tragically abroad. I laughed, and he didn't ask for a second dance. Just as well. He was like shifting sticks. All the while, Rose slouched over her beer in that lovely suit. She didn't bat an eye until I danced with my pal, Nico. It bothered her, I could tell. Although why it should be any different than with the white fellas, I don't know. Only difference I can see is, except for the stocky Irishman, the Negro men are the best on their feet. When I sat back down at the table while the band took a break, Rose said, "I'll dance with you if you teach me." It was the first thing she'd said for an hour. I realized I had wanted to make her jealous. It bugged me that we had made it all the way to this club with her looking so gorgeous, but all she wanted to do was sulk. I asked her how she liked the show. "Irredeemably puerile." "The dancing was great."
"The outfits are an outrage."
"Look who's talking."
"At least I'm fully clothed."
I made her take a sip of my whiskey. Then I did something crazy. I kissed her on the lips. Just quickly, you know, but we both blushed. She didn't object. She simply raised her hand for the waiter and demanded 2 more drinks in a deep voice to make me laugh, then whispered desperately in my ear, "Do you have enough money?" I brushed my ear against her lips. She stayed perfectly still. I kissed her neck between the stiff white collar and her earlobe. I slipped my hand round the back of her head below her hat and stroked that gentle dip at the base of the skull. She turned slightly and kissed my mouth. So softly. I forgot where we were. That we were anywhere. We just looked at each other. "So that's who you are." The drinks came, and Rose looked away, shy again. What will happen to me if Rose ever ceases to be shy? I will have an attack of all the shyness I've been saving up. Then something happened that I'd never seen before. The place flooded and turned overwhelmingly black, men and women both. I'll bet if I'd looked hard enough, I'd have seen the ladies from Rose's front steps braving the devil's music. The word must have spread since I'd been here. The house lights dimmed and the footlights shimmered on the minarets of Mecca. Silence fell over the whole joint, and the impresario stepped up to invoke the goddess of blues.
"Ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, the Empress of the Blues, Cleopatra of Jazz, the lowest, the highest, the holiest, the sweetest Miss Jessie Hogan."
Applause and shouts to outdo the bravissimas of a grand finale, though the curtain has yet to open. It parts purple and gold to reveal pearls and peacock blue. 14 carats wink at every compass point. She starts off in a spotlight and emits a single moan. It goes on for minutes, growing, subsiding, exploding, until you're not sure if she's praying or cursing. She drags her voice over gravel, then soothes it with silk. She crucifies, dies, buries, and rises. It will come again to save the living and the dead. People spontaneously applaud and shout, sometimes all together, sometimes singly. La Hogan is absolutely silent after the opening sacrament, while God descends invisibly to investigate. Then, once he's split and the coast is clear, she spurts like a trumpet till the trumpet can't take it any more and hits her back. They fight blow for blow till she raises her arms and calls a truce. She takes a step off the stage. The audience yelps, the trombone belts a shocked comment, and she bursts into her song without words, quadruple time, strutting to the center of the hall, dancing, the band following her like obedient treasure-bearers, except for piano. The drummer beats on every passing surface. People start clapping time as the Hogan somehow threads her stuff between the spindly tables and throngs of faithful. At the end of that first number, she says, "Welcome and good evening," just as though she were an ordinary mortal. Sweat streams from her pearl headband, and she flashes her ivory and gold smile. I guess she must weigh a good 200 pounds. I looked over at Rose. While everyone else in the place was swaying and rocking and beaming, she sat perfectly serious, listening and watching. Afterward, you know what she said about the music? Crude, but compelling. High praise indeed. Under a smoky street lamp, I stood face to face with my beloved and pricked my fingers against the diamond studs of her immaculate shirt front. Being tall, she slipped her hands naturally about my hips and pulled me close. And being bold, I put my mouth on hers, and this time went inside and told her all the things I'd been longing to. Dark and sweet, the elixir of love is in her mouth. The more I drink, the more I remember all the things we've never done. I was a ghost until I touched you. Never swallowed mortal food until I tasted you. Never understood the spoken word until I found your tongue. I've been a sleepwalker, sad somnambula, hands outstretched to strike the solid thing that could awaken me to life at last. I have only ever stood here under this lamp against your body. I've missed you all my life. She kissed my face like fire. And it happened. I grew shy and could only give her the top of my head, which she kissed anyway. She said in a voice I'd never heard before, "I didn't think you had a scent, but you do." Which made me laugh, because what a thing to say. But she explained, "No, everyone has a scent, and you either like it or you don't, or you're indifferent. And you had no scent, and I thought that was spooky." "You're easily spooked," I love talking with our arms around each other.
It made you seem not quite human, she said.
I'm not.
Don't.
Scaredy cat. She kissed me again, and we didn't stop for a long time,
except to lean out of the light when we heard horses coming.
We slipped into an alley, and I pulled her shirt out from her pants. I pressed my center into her, and she sighed. It made me flood from inside, the sweetest music. We were finally dancing. I slid my hands under and up her smooth sides. I wanted to be slow to savor, but we couldn't. She gripped me and moved under me. I felt her nipples under my palms, and I think I died. Rose gasped as though I'd stabbed her, and I felt like a savage robbing a sacred tree, her thigh between my legs. I found her hand and led it to a place I know. I kissed it with the mouth that I keep hidden, then took her inside and sucked her like the greedy tide that can't decide to swallow or disgorge. I lost track of everything, and even after I finally could stop, I knew that I would never be finished. Oh, Rose, it's not enough until I have all of you inside me, then give you back to the world fresh and new from my belly. She just said softly, oh, for the longest time. Imagine, in an alley. It's not very romantic, but somehow it was. Terribly. Crude, but compelling.
The sign says Lebanon.
Could I really have slept so long? Lily wonders.
I said out.
Lily emerges from the gloom of the boxcar, and the signalman is remorseful.
Need some help there?
Thank you, sir.
Where are you going, Missy?
New York City.
Well, you're a bit off in that case, ain't ya?
I'm in Lebanon. Where's New York?
80 or so miles back the way you come. To Portland, then turn right. Hey, where are you going?
Back.
You can't walk.
Yes, I can. Don't worry. 2 hours later.
Hello again, Missy.
Hello, sir. I forgot my mother's diary on the train. He hand-pumps them over the rails 12 miles to the lumber yards. He climbs into 29 boxcars.
This it?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Here.
Thank you, sir.
Don't wait too long to eat it. There's mayo in it.
Don't worry. September 6th. Music class every morning, Mecca every night. It's clear which Rose is in disguise. Saturday the 7th. Yesterday, Jean leaned in close to me and said, "You remind me of someone, Peaches." "I bet," I said. "Really, Jean? Who?" And she said, with her crooked smile that is apparently worth paying for, "Me." I didn't say anything. She took a big drag off her fag, held it in, then exhaled.
"I'll bet your daddy's just crazy about you."
I've taken to saying a Hail Mary before I come into the apartment. Monday the 9th. You have never seen two such professionals. The Kaiser is delighted with my progress. Sometimes he just says to me,
"Sing,"
and to Rose,
"Miss Lacroix, play if you please,"
and sits back. How the mighty have mellowed. We're just gently sculling till November. I do sometimes get a jolting sensation. No sooner do I take leave of Rose in the afternoon in her ribbons and bows and dead composers than I meet my lover in the snazzy suit for a night of jazz and jive. We tried it. It's made from a plant. Lovely aroma. Bought it from the Chinaman. Makes you lose time. Makes you hear each note of music from every direction at once. Makes you make love slowly. But I haven't bought any more because I don't want my awake senses dulled. If all music is fascinating, then none is, and there's plenty of time to slow down. There's the whole rest of our lives. For 3 nights we didn't go to Mecca. I went to Rose's place and waited while she doctored her mother and changed clothes. I've given her the sash from my new green dress. I wound it around her charcoal hat to remind her. She said she doesn't require reminding. Then she kissed me in that way that makes me hate time. We dined and went out. We can't stay at her place because of Jean's company. We passed one of her gentlemen on the stairs the second night, an older, light brown man with a paunch and a monocle. He runs the credit union, Rose told me. I guess Jean does pretty well. Covers her doctor bills, anyhow. Enough men will pay for a blonde princess, even if she's washed up and strung out. It's not her job that bothers me. It's her. What I get from Jean is a big echo. Where is she, really? She still hasn't said a word about having seen us. I'm used to being there now when Rose gives her a shot. That's all she cares about. She still cooks and sets the table for 3 every night, even though she is always horizontal by supper time. Come to think of it, I have never seen her eat. And I'm used to her sleazy, stuck-up manner. The other evening she drawled at me, "I'm a Burgess, you know. I don't know if Rosie told you. One of the Long Island Burgesses. My father was George Morecambe Burgess." And I drawled back, "Oh, really? I'm a piper, one of the Cape Breton Island pipers. Perhaps you've heard of my father, James." Her smile is now more sneer than leer, which is how I know she respects me somewhat. She plays cat and mouse. "Kathleen, dear, don't you have a young man waiting for you in torment somewhere?" And after a few more drinks, "Beware the dark fruit, darling. He'll leave you high, oh so high, but dry, baby, to the bone." How am I different from Jean? She is addicted to morphine. I am addicted to rose. A rose is not a poppy. That is how I am different from Jean. Something happened after Boston. Lily kept to the highway with the water blinking on her left, and all was well until she noticed water on both sides. Then there was no more land. "Is this Manhattan?" It took a while before someone would answer her. A boy whipped a handful of sand and shells. "Fucking moron." A clutch of ringleted pre-debs giggled behind their hands and ran away holding their noses. A long, open automobile whizzed by. The sea was very pretty here, so Lily sat down on a wharf to read and wait until things became clear. A lobster fisherman told her where she was and gave her a juicy claw out of his cauldron. "The water's so blue," she said.
"Is this your first time seeing the ocean?"
"No, but my ocean is gray and green."
"Where are you from?"
"Canada."
"Oh, yeah? I have a cousin in Vancouver. Maybe you know her."
"Maybe I do." Our first 3 nights after that first night, we stroll to Central Park, a place near the pond. Rose brings a blanket and I bring chokecherry wine. There's a thicket that you enter like a rabbit. You crawl for 10 feet or so, then you can stand up and see the stars. And only the stars can see you back. We spread the blanket. Then we always share a glass of wine before we touch. I thought I would get calmer, surer. But each time we come close, I feel almost sick at first, as though each time vibrates with the times before. I feel a terrible sorrow coming up my throat. I don't know why. And it can only be consoled against the length of her body. Lying down with her for the first time, all the pain I didn't know I had. Till at her touch it disappeared like smoke. Is this what purgatory feels like? To burn painlessly? If so, why isn't it called heaven? When my fingers slide against beautiful Rose, when they swell her to a sweet unfolding, and she puffs out like a sail at my every breath, when they glisten into her and disappear, it's as though she were a soldier fallen in the field getting healed by me, her head to one side. I take off her uniform, and she can finally come home. You don't know how beautiful she is. Her hair finally released, black foam. Her skin, nocturnal waters worshipped by the moon. Her white lover. I fold her clothes carefully and dress her with my tongue, my hands, my wet center, the true balm of Gilead. Did you know it closes wounds and opens hearts? My pale green silk dress is what they'd call an undergarment at home. I wear only it. It slips like skin and conforms to the slightest caress like the shirt of a Mongol warrior meant to smooth the piercing arrow's exit from the wound. It casts an arboreal shade when I kneel above Rose and invite her to refresh herself in this cool glade. Look, I say, and I can feel the caress of her eyes. Touch me, and it's the closest thing to having no skin. Kiss me. She guides my hips, lowering me to her lips as though to sip from a legendary flask. The more you drink, the fuller it gets. Rose was a bit shocked at first, but I have discovered something about modest people. They're just waiting for the call. Then they are the first over the wall and into the temple. When she's inside, I sometimes think of her fingers on the piano. Wicked, I know, but I can't help it. She is endowed with a span of a tenth. I sometimes sing a line of La Traviata between her thighs, which scandalizes her because she is as serious about sex as she is about music. Reverent. When will she discover that I am from a lesser race of immortals? But the high deities have always needed pixies to persuade them down to earth. When she no longer needs an intermediary, will she still love me? I love you, Rose. I love you. I love you. Love you. Who? Kathleen. Then we bathe in the pond. When I arrived home on the third night, morning, actually, Giles was up already with the coffee perking. I thought, oh no. This is it. She was in her heavy brocade dressing gown with the Louis XIV sheep frolicking. Somewhere there is a parlor with a naked armchair. But really, what am I to make of her? She put the marmalade on the table and said wispily, Kathleen, dear, I'd really rather you brought your friend home nights. I'm acting cocky here on paper, but I nearly spewed, she said. I know you two have formed an attachment, and naturally friends lose track of time. There just seems to be so much to talk about. My throat closed. I couldn't swallow the coffee. How much does she know? Does she imagine that we talk Verdi till dawn, that we plan to enter the convent together? But I said, thank you. It would be nice if Rose could spend some time here. Her home situation is not the most wholesome. Poor thing. She's welcome to stay and use the piano, too, any time. Jesus Murphy. Gosh, I said. That's awfully generous of you, Giles. No, Kathleen, it's selfish. She twinkled at me, sipped her coffee, and crinkled the newspaper. I decided not to look a gift horse in the mouth. No wonder people in Cape Cod thought I was crazy, thought Lily. No one would ever mistake the island of Manhattan for any other place once they'd seen it.
The highway had become Broadway. She had crossed the Harlem River and asked, "Where's Central Park?" This time she was confident that it was a sensible question. But people still didn't want to answer for some reason. They looked quickly away. Finally, a big white lady with fruit on her hat said,
"Come with me, child."
Lily wound up at a mission in the East Village, where a volunteer lady tried to get her into a bath in a new dress. Lily bargained. "You may wash my dress, but I do not want a new dress, and you may wash me, but I will not remove my boots. Thank you."
"Your ankles are badly swollen.
I've been walking a lot."
"You're actually quite pretty under all that grime, aren't you?"
"Thank you."
"Poor little thing.
I'm not poor."
"God loves you."
"I know."
Lily's green silk dress began to disintegrate at the first hint of water.
"This is fit for the trash," said the lady, and the next instant shrieked in pain.
"What happened?"
asked the matron, who came running, and the charity worker replied, "Little bitch bit me." But by then, Lily had her dress, her brace, and her diary, and was out the door. A pale man with long black hair, a top hat, and curly sideburns pointed north. She entered through the south gate of Central Park and found the pond as evening fell. She looked for the thicket, but couldn't find it. She found an untenanted bench, curled up, hugged the diary, and fell asleep. She moved several times, awakened by the crack of a billy stick on the soles of her feet.
"Move along!"
And more than once, as she rose and began to walk away,
"I'm sorry, little girl. Don't you have anywhere to go?"
"Yes, thank you. Don't worry."
"Are you all alone?"
"No, my brother is with me."
September 23rd. She said, "There's a tree growing inside you." In my little room with the Greenwich roofs beyond the window, red geraniums, cool metropolitan night air, industrial blue. We lie next to each other a long time, looking, lightly touching, as involuntary as breath, black and white. Except she thinks I'm actually green.
"There, see?"
She traces the green shoots of this alleged sapling, starting from behind my ear, down my neck, where it submerges, then surfaces at the base of my breast, reaching up, cleaving in two twigs to encircle my nipple. She finds more evidence at my inner thigh.
"It's growing up to your belly button. I wonder where the roots are."
"It depends whether I'm a shade tree or an aquatic plant."
"You're green."
"My eyes are green."
"You're so white, you're green."
"You say the sweetest things."
"You're beautiful."
"I'm green."
"The green diva. La diva verde."
"And I smell."
"You have a scent."
"So do you,"
I said. "What's mine?"
"Trade winds."
"Huh."
"Everything that's ever been worth stealing."
"Hmm."
"What's mine?"
"Mineral."
"You know, it's because I know you that I'm able to translate. I know that what you're really saying is, 'Darling, you're ravishing. Milk and honey are under your tongue.'"
"And the smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon."
"Huh?" She kissed me. And after a while, she said,
"Actually, you smell like the sea."
"What do you know from the sea? There's no sea in